9 minutes and 29 seconds. That's how long Derek Chauvin knelt on George Floyd's neck. But the real story, it lasted centuries. I'm an investigative journalist, and in this series, I uncover the systems that made that moment possible. From courtroom silence to bureaucratic spin, from city hall memos to police union contracts, this isn't just a true crime story, and it's a national indictment. We'll examine the protests, the trial, the surveillance, and the cover-ups, because justice isn't a verdict, it's a reckoning. And if you think George Floyd's story ended with a guilty conviction, you haven't been paying attention. This is Shadows of Justice, the George Floyd case, and it's time we told the truth. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1, 9 minutes, 29 seconds. They say 9 minutes and 29 seconds, but I've watched that video dozens of times, and let me tell you, it doesn't feel like time. It feels like eternity. Because when a man pleads for his life, when he calls for his mother with his face pressed to the pavement, when a police officer keeps his knee on that man's neck long after the body beneath him stops moving, that's not enforcement. That's execution. And it happened in broad daylight in front of cell phones, children, and the world. I remember exactly where I was when I first saw it. I had just wrapped up a segment on local election fraud when the raw footage hit Twitter. No warning, no blur, just the unfiltered reality of George Floyd dying under Officer Derek Chauvin's knee. My inbox exploded within minutes. Civil rights lawyers, activists, a retired detective I once interviewed in Baton Rouge. "You need to look into this," they all said. "Don't let them bury it." You know, and at first I thought, "No, how could they? It's all on tape, a knee, a man, no resistance." But I knew better, because I've seen how quickly the shadows of justice can stretch when the victim is black and the killer wears a badge. So I started digging. The first thing I got my hands on was the original police press release. I still have it. A few lines, clinical, detached, almost sterile. "Man dies after medical incident during police interaction." That's what they called it, a medical incident. As if George Floyd just happened to die on the sidewalk in the middle of an arrest. No mention of the knee, no mention of the officer. Just vague bureaucratic language, the kind that hides systemic violence behind passive verbs. I filed my first FOIA request the next morning. Body camera footage, use of force reports, internal MPD memos. What I got back was 83 pages, more than half of it redacted in thick black ink, carefully curated, legally justified, morally corrupt. I spoke to a Minneapolis paramedic who responded to the scene. I promised anonymity. They told me George Floyd had no pulse when they arrived. The officers hadn't even attempted CPR. "We checked for signs of life," the paramedic said, "but it was too late. We weren't called to treat him. We were called to declare him dead." Meanwhile, the world erupted, but inside MPD headquarters, the mood was very different. I know this because a junior officer, someone who trained under Chauvin, reached out. He said what no one wanted to hear. "This wasn't a mistake," he told me. "This was routine. We've been doing this for years." I asked him what he meant. He said the knee on neck tactic wasn't officially sanctioned, but it wasn't forbidden either. "It's taught in the field," he explained. "Quietly, it's considered control." Control. That's what this is about. Control of the body, control of the narrative, control of the system. I pulled Chauvin's record, 18 prior complaints, one verbal reprimand, no suspensions, no charges. And then I found the real bombshell. Chauvin had once been involved in a fatal shooting of another black man, but the department cleared him. I started drawing lines, every name, every file. The patterns weren't subtle. This wasn't just about George Floyd. It was about what his death represented. A system designed not to protect, but to shield. I interviewed a woman named Angela who lived three doors down from Cup Foods, the store where Floyd allegedly used the counterfeit $20 bill. And she told me Floyd was a regular. The clerks knew him, said he'd never caused trouble, said he looked panicked when the cops arrived, like he already knew what was going to happen. And that's another thing that stuck with me, the fear, the deep generational in the bone fear of black people encountering police. This fear is not irrational. It is historical. It is American. Over the next 72 hours, I tracked the public reaction. MPD said it was launching an internal review. The mayor made a somber statement about tragedy. But behind the scenes, prosecutors hesitated. Days passed. Chauvin wasn't arrested. Let me be clear. Had George Floyd done to Chauvin what Chauvin did to Floyd, he'd have been booked within the hour. But this was a waiting game, a bureaucracy game, one where cops get lawyers before citizens get answers. I interviewed a legal scholar at the University of Minnesota. He described it as wealth shielding without the wealth, institutional immunity for state actors. By the end of that week, the pressure mounted, protesters gathered, the world watched, and yet the system did what it always does, getting stalwart the truth. I got a call from someone who worked inside the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Off the record, they said there's a debate about whether this even qualifies as murder. Some of them are calling it an accident. I hung up the phone, my jaw clenched. I looked at the screen again, 9 minutes, 29 seconds. There was no accident. There was time to stop, time to breathe, time to live, and they stole it from him. Chapter 2, The Blueprint of Brutality. The file sent to me was real. I confirmed that within hours. A disciplinary complaint from 2017 submitted by a Somali-American teenager who claimed Derek Chauvin violently slammed his head into a patrol car door during a routine stop. The boy was never charged, but the case was quietly closed, marked unsubstantiated due to lack of evidence. But there was evidence, witnesses, a blurry cell phone video, a medical report from Hennepin County Medical Center showing a mild concussion and lacerations. So why was it buried? I asked around. No one at Internal Affairs would speak to me on the record. But an ex-MPD supervisor, now retired and living in Arizona, offered a damning truth. The culture was always cover your own. Chauvin was protected because he got the job done no matter how dirty the work. It wasn't the first time I'd heard that phrase, get the job done. In law enforcement, it's code for brutality with plausible deniability. So I began digging into Chauvin's entire history, not just as an officer, but as an institutional creation. What I found was a blueprint, a pattern of conduct molded, encouraged, and insulated by layers of bureaucracy and silence. Chauvin joined MPD in 2001. Within 5 years, he had his first fatal shooting. Wayne Reyes, Latino, accused of threatening officers with a shotgun, killed instantly, no charges filed. In 2006, he was one of six officers who opened fire on a stabbing suspect. That one also went nowhere. Over the years, 18 complaints were filed against him. Only one resulted in disciplinary action, a letter of reprimand. I requested access to the complaint summaries through public record. What I got was a pile of sanitized phrases. Officer exercised discretion. No pattern of misconduct found. No follow-up required. But survivors told me different stories. As I met with a black woman named Charnell, who claimed Chauvin forcibly removed her from a traffic stop in 2014, twisted her arm so badly she couldn't work for weeks, and then wrote in the police report that she had resisted. She tried to see, her case was dismissed in pretrial motions. It wasn't just him, she said, it was the people who let him stay. And that's where the real story lies. Chauvin was a product of a system that rewards aggression and punishes accountability. The MPD's internal affairs unit had long been described as ineffective, a bureaucratic wall rather than a mechanism for justice. Officers investigated themselves. Many went years without consequences, even when video or civilian testimony suggested excessive force. And then I found the training manuals. Yes, kneeling on a suspect's neck wasn't standard procedure, but I uncovered old PowerPoint slides used in MPD use of force seminars that listed knee to neck control as a transitional hold, a gray zone, a loophole, a phrase that gave officers cover if a suspect ended up injured or worse. This wasn't negligence. This was design. I interviewed a police reform advocate who described Minneapolis as a city with progressive rhetoric and regressive policing. Politicians made speeches, but they approved bloated police budgets, signed off on union contracts that made it nearly impossible to fire problem officers, and looked the other way when community complaints piled up. One city council member agreed to speak under condition of anonymity. "We were scared of the union," she told me. "They controlled discipline boards, paid for legal defenses, and made it politically toxic to call for accountability." In 2012, Chauvin received a department award for bravery. I tracked down what the citation was for. Turns out it was for a raid where he stormed into a home and restrained a suspect without incident. That suspect, unarmed, no drugs found, later released. But awards like that build reputations, and reputations protect officers from scrutiny. It's the illusion of valor, the uniform, the badge, the narrative. It all becomes part of the story the system wants you to see. But behind that narrative is a ledger of pain, a list of names. George Floyd was just the one we watched die. And the silence of those around Chauvin, that wasn't hesitation, that was training, that was muscle memory. The thin blue line is not just loyalty, it's a strategy of silence. Three other officers stood there. One of them, Tu Thao, had a prior excessive force lawsuit of his own. The city paid out $25,000 to settle it. He never saw a day of suspension. Another, Thomas Lane, was on his fourth day on the job, the rookie. But even he didn't intervene. Why? Because intervention means risking your career, because in many departments, defying brutality is punished more than committing it. I spoke to a former MPD officer who left the force in 2019. "You learn real quick," he said, "don't question your field training officer. Don't contradict your partner. Don't write anything that makes another cop look bad." He looked me in the eye. "We don't stop each other. That's the job." Chapter 3, Policing Blackness. I stared at the spreadsheet for hours, rows and rows of names, every one of them tied to an MPD use of force report. I ran a filter, race, date, outcome. The pattern emerged fast. Black and brown bodies filled the columns. White officers filled the margins. There's something brutal about data. It doesn't shout. It doesn't cry. It just sits there, quiet, clinical, undeniable. And this was not anecdotal. It was systemic. Over the past decade, black residents made up less than 20% of Minneapolis's population, but they represented nearly 60% of police use of force cases. These weren't isolated incidents. They were proof of a policing model that criminalized blackness itself. I needed voices behind the numbers. I met with Jamil, a local youth counselor born and raised in North Minneapolis. We sat in a park two blocks from where he was first cuffed at the age of 13, for loitering with suspicion. "That's what they wrote," he said, laughing bitterly. "Loitering with suspicion. What does that even mean?" I knew what it meant. It meant walking while black, standing while black, existing while black. "The first time I had a gun pulled on me," he continued, "I was 16. Cops said I fit the description. I was wearing a school uniform." He paused. "I've never called the police in my life. I don't even know what it's like to feel protected by them." That is the psychological toll of over-policing, the erasure of safety, the normalization of fear. I reviewed MPD's public use of force dashboard, chokeholds, neck restraints, canine bites, nearly all disproportionately used on black suspects. In one report, an officer used a chemical irritant on a 12-year-old boy. The department ruled it within policy. I interviewed a data scientist from the University of Minnesota. Her research focused on algorithmic bias in police databases. "When your data is racist," she told me, "your policies follow suit. Predictive policing software just replicates the same broken patterns." And that's the heart of it, yeah, the false neutrality of bureaucracy. The problem isn't just the individual officer, it's the entire operational framework, the metrics, the incentives, the training. I reviewed MPD's academy syllabus, less than 10% focused on de-escalation. More than 30% was dedicated to officer survival. Survival, not of the community, but of the officer. And then there's the piano studio. George Floyd's family told me he loved music. played keys in a local church, wrote lyrics. I found an old video of him helping a young man learn to read sheet music. He's smiling, patient, teaching. How do you go from playing piano to dying face down on a street corner under someone's knee? Because when you're black in America, your humanity isn't the starting point, it's the exception. The next person I met was James, a black police officer who left the force after 11 years. We met in a diner south of St. Paul. I joined to change the system from the inside, he said. But I realized the system wasn't built to be changed, it was built to control. He told me about an internal culture of silence. You speak up, they freeze you out, call you a liability. Next thing you know, your backup stops showing up on calls. That wasn't just dangerous, that was calculated. I asked him about Chauvin. Not surprised, he said. He was the kind they promoted. Quiet, aggressive, always wrote reports that made the department look good. That's the blueprint. And what about black neighborhoods? We weren't taught to serve them. We were taught to manage them. Manage, like a problem, like a liability, like a threat. The deeper I went, the more I saw that blackness was not only over-policed, it was over-suspected, over-punished, and under-protected. Philando Castile, that name kept coming up in my mind. St. Anthony police officer Geronimo Yanez pulls Castile over for a broken taillight. Castile tells him calmly that he has a legally licensed firearm. Yanez panics, fires 7 shots. Castile dies in front of his girlfriend and her 4-year-old daughter. It's live streamed on Facebook. Yanez is charged, but acquitted. The NRA says nothing. The system moves on. That's the depths of crime we rarely explore, not just the act, but the judicial architecture that ensures certain victims remain voiceless. Black death is often public, but black justice is private, delayed, denied, or deleted. Later that night, I reviewed more data. One report showed that MPD was nearly 7 times more likely to use force against black residents than white ones. Another showed black drivers were twice as likely to be searched and less likely to be found carrying contraband. Yet still, the official stance was always the same. We do not tolerate racial bias. We follow the data. We police based on behavior, not identity. But I had the data, I had the interviews, I had the stories, and I knew what I was seeing. This wasn't a behavior-based policing. This was racialized control. This was policing blackness. Octon Chapter 4, The Anatomy of a Cover-Up. I printed out the leaked memo and pinned it to my wall. It was short, barely a page, but it said everything about how power works when confronted with truth. The subject line, damage control talking points, date May 26, 2020, 1 day after George Floyd took his last breath, and there, in bold, emphasize Floyd's criminal history, downplay use of force specifics, reinforce law and order narrative, redirect attention to unrest. No mention of the knee, no commitment to accountability, just spin. That memo wasn't an anomaly. It was a blueprint, one used again and again whenever law enforcement kills a black man on camera, not to investigate, but to discredit, not to prosecute, but to preserve image. This is the anatomy of a cover-up. Step 1, sanitize the initial police report. MPD's original statement claimed Floyd physically resisted. I reviewed the body camera footage. Floyd was scared, yes, emotionally distressed, absolutely, but he wasn't violent. He was already handcuffed when they forced him to the ground, his face in the pavement, his voice trembling. Step 2, shift the narrative from what officers did to who the victim was. That very same day, media outlets began recirculating Floyd's prior arrests, 2007, 2013, misdemeanors, time served. But the goal wasn't legal, it was psychological. They wanted you to ask, was he a good victim? Because if not, maybe you'd accept his death as less outrageous, less criminal. That's the trap of respectability politics, and it's part of the machinery of injustice. Step 3, bureaucratic delay. Despite national protests and a global outcry, it took 4 full days to arrest Derek Chauvin. During that time, I watched as prosecutors passed the case back and forth like a live grenade. First Hennepin County, then the Minnesota Attorney General, then the U.S. Department of Justice made a statement. Monitoring, I've covered federal investigations before. Monitoring is usually code for stalling, so I pushed harder. I contacted a former DOJ civil rights attorney. She had worked on the consent decree in Ferguson, Missouri after the death of Michael Brown. You're not just fighting the police, she told me. You're fighting the unions, the prosecutors, the city councils, all of it. The system protects itself first. I uncovered a timeline buried in local legal records. Prior misconduct cases involving MPD officers had, on average, taken 11 months to resolve. In those cases, officers were almost never fired. Even when found guilty, they were usually reassigned or quietly retired with pensions intact. That's not justice. That's wealth shielding in uniform. I tracked the mayor's press conferences, watched his tone change from let the investigation run its course to we demand justice, but the shift didn't come until the protests grew, until buildings started burning and the national spotlight became too hot to ignore. At the same time, I discovered another pattern, the red tape that slows every effort at real reform. In 2018, the Minneapolis Office of Police Conduct Review recommended 20 policy updates, including new neck restraint rules. Only 4 were implemented. Why? Budget limitations, I was told. Union pushback. Training schedule conflicts. Excuses stacked on procedures stacked on silence. Meanwhile, George Floyd was dead. I filed more public records requests, use of force review board findings, internal disciplinary protocols, city council emails. The responses came back with delays, weeks-long delays. I had to threaten legal action to even get timestamps. And then I found a name. Officer Matthew H., a member of the review panel who had voted against investigating Chauvin in a 2016 excessive force case. I called him. "It's complicated," he said. "Why?" I asked. "Wasn't there video, witnesses?" "Yes, but Chauvin was considered reliable." Reliable. That's the word they use for officers who don't make waves. Officers who do the job the way the department wants it done. Fast, aggressive, unquestioned. Reliable means dangerous. It means protected. It means repeat offenders. I met with a legal advocate from the Minnesota ACLU. She called the process performance accountability. They act like they're investigating. They hold pressers. But behind the scenes, they're managing risk, not delivering justice. Every public statement is scripted. Every policy review is delayed. Every death becomes a PR crisis to survive, not a human tragedy to confront. And what about the autopsy? That's where the cover-up reached its cruelest point. The official Hennepin County autopsy labeled Floyd's cause of death as cardiopulmonary arrest. No mention of asphyxiation, no ruling of homicide. Instead, the report listed underlying health conditions, hypertension, heart disease, as contributing factors. It read like a defense memo, not a medical document. Then the Floyd family released their own independent autopsy. Cause of death, mechanical asphyxia due to sustained pressure. Translation, he suffocated under a knee. The conflicting reports weren't just scientific differences. They were political battlegrounds fought over a black man's body. I called the lead pathologist on the independent report. He told me the pressure on Floyd's neck and back was absolutely fatal and entirely preventable. It was homicide, he said. Full stop. Chapter 5, Streets on Fire. It started with candles, then chants, then cardboard signs. By the time I arrived in Minneapolis, the air smelled like smoke and tear gas, a mixture of grief and rebellion that settled in your lungs and didn't let go. I'd been to protests before, Ferguson, Baltimore, Baton Rouge, but this was different. This wasn't just about George Floyd. This was a collective scream built over centuries. The people weren't just angry, they were exhausted. I walked alongside them on Lake Street. It was quiet at first. Young black organizers at the front, college students, mothers with children. Then came the clash, the line of riot shields, the barking orders from megaphones, the hiss of gas canisters flying into crowds. It was not a riot. It was a release. Every sign told a story. Justice for George. I can't breathe. Defund the police. No more names. And the names, my God, the names. Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, Breonna Taylor, Eric Garner, Philando Castile. The list wasn't just growing, it was looping. As a journalist, I wasn't there to chant, but I couldn't pretend to be neutral either. There's no neutrality when the state kneels on someone's neck. There's only accountability or complicity. That night, I spoke to Tayana, a 23-year-old local who had organized her first protest route just 2 days prior. We're not burning buildings, she told me. We're burning illusions. The illusion that the law protects us, that justice is blind, that black lives are equal. Behind her, a squad car burned. Officers in gas masks advanced through alleys. And yet, what most of the news didn't show was that the protests were largely peaceful until the police showed up. I filmed what I saw. Lines of protesters kneeling, singing, holding signs, and then, without warning, rubber bullets, tear gas, baton charges. I documented more than a dozen unprovoked uses of force on camera. Later, I compared that footage to the official MPD press statements. They claimed officers responded to aggressive rioters, but my timestamps told a different story. There was a script, and the facts weren't part of it. In the days that followed, the uprising spread like wildfire. Los Angeles, Chicago, Atlanta, London, Cape Town. 26 million people protested across all 50 U.S. states. It became the largest civil rights movement in American history, and still no arrest. Derek Chauvin remained a free man. Meanwhile, journalists were arrested. I watched one colleague get pepper sprayed while standing behind police lines. Another was shot with a rubber round while holding a clearly marked press badge. I remember thinking, if they do this to us, what are they doing when no one's watching? I reached out to a legal observer embedded with a Minneapolis protest watchdog group. She told me that in the first 72 hours of protests, over 400 complaints of excessive police force had already been logged, many of them from people who were peacefully marching. And still, politicians across the country called for calm. But what does calm mean when the state is the aggressor? The narrative was shifting, and the institutions were scrambling. In a leaked memo from a federal fusion center, one of those law enforcement intelligence sharing hubs, I found something that stopped me cold, a list of potential threat actors. Most were what you'd expect, violent agitators, known extremists, but one name stood out, not a suspect, a local pastor, black, community leader, known for peaceful protests. He was flagged for rhetoric promoting civil disruption. I contacted him directly. They surveilled me for quoting Martin Luther King, he said. I gave a sermon. That's it. And now I'm on a watch list. This wasn't just policing of bodies anymore. It was policing of speech. And it wasn't just local. DHS drones were deployed over protests in 15 cities. The FBI sent agents to infiltrate activist spaces. Phones were tapped, social media monitored. The protests became the next crime scene. And when the state was the suspect. Back in Minneapolis, the people pushed harder. On May 29th, the third precinct burned, not because someone ordered it, but because it symbolized every time the system turned its back. It was never about the building. It was about the people it failed to protect. The next morning, Chauvin was arrested. 4 days, one building, millions of voices. Justice didn't move until the fire reached the institution's front porch. But even then, something felt off. The charge was third-degree murder, a lesser offense. A prosecutor's safety net, easier to prove, less accountability. That's when the legal chess match began. And behind the courtroom drama, something else was happening. City governments were in damage control mode. Mayors scrambled to promise reforms. Police unions doubled down. And quietly, bills were introduced in state legislatures, not to protect black lives, but to increase penalties for protesters, to shield police budgets, to criminalize dissent. Backlash is policy, an organizer told me. It always has been. Chapter 6, The Trial of a Nation. When Derek Chauvin walked into the courtroom on March 29th, 2021, he didn't wear a uniform, no badge, no visible signs of the power he once wielded. But make no mistake, the institution was still standing behind him. I sat three rows behind the Floyd family. Cameras weren't allowed in the federal courtroom, but the state had approved live broadcast, a rare concession driven by public pressure and fear of unrest. This trial wasn't just about guilt or innocence. It was about whether a nation would face itself. The prosecution's strategy was clear. Keep the focus on the video. 9 minutes and 29 seconds, again and again. Each time it played, you could feel the room shrink. They called it what it was, murder. Prosecutor Jerry Blackwell told the jury, "You can believe your eyes. This was not policing. This was unnecessary. This was excessive. This was deadly." The defense, on the other hand, tried to complicate the obvious. They pointed to underlying health conditions, to drug intoxication, to crowd distraction, was all strategies designed to blur the simple truth. Because when facts are too clear, the system muddies the water. They brought in experts, a pulmonologist who testified that Floyd died from low oxygen caused by sustained pressure, a use of force trainer who said Chauvin violated department protocol. Even the Minneapolis police chief, Chauvin's own superior, testified against him. That was historic. But I noticed something in the jury's faces: fatigue. Not just from the testimony, but from the emotional weight of watching a man die over and over again. I spoke with legal scholars every night, off record. They warned me that despite the evidence, convictions against police officers in America were exceedingly rare. Less than 2% of officers charged with murder or manslaughter are convicted. And those are just the ones charged. We talked about jury psychology, reasonable doubt, and the unspoken power of the uniform, even after it's removed. And then came the defense's witness list: one toxicologist, one retired officer, and a use of force expert who argued that Chauvin's actions were justified under policy. I reviewed his previous cases. He had testified in favor of officers in every single instance, including one where a man was tased to death in police custody. Professional doubt, bought and packaged. Meanwhile, outside the courthouse, the streets pulsed with tension. People camped out. Artists painted murals. A giant fist rose over George Floyd Square. But it wasn't celebration. It was watchfulness. Because we'd seen the story go the other way too many times. Rodney King, Amadou Diallo, Oscar Grant, Eric Garner, Philando Castile, each name a trial, each trial a wound. I checked in with George Floyd's brother, Philanice, the night before closing arguments. He was exhausted but composed. "I just want people to see my brother as a human," he said, "not a hashtag, not a file, a father, a son, a man." That's what justice really means, humanization. The morning of the verdict, downtown Minneapolis shut down. Schools went remote. Shops boarded their windows. National Guard troops patrolled intersections. They were preparing for one of two outcomes, relief or rage. And then the jury came back. 10 hours of deliberation, three words: guilty, 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 second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, second-degree manslaughter. The courtroom erupted in silence, that strange kind of stillness that only comes after too much pain. Tears fell, shoulders dropped, people exhaled. But I didn't cheer because I knew what others knew. One verdict is not justice, it's accountability. And accountability is the floor, not the ceiling. As I walked outside, a crowd had gathered. Some were celebrating, some crying, some just staring. A young black girl looked up at her mother and asked, "Does this mean they'll stop killing us now?" Her mother didn't answer. And in that silence was the most honest answer we have. Chapter 7, Accountability Not Equal to Justice. The headlines read like victory: Chauvin convicted, justice served, a turning point for America. But inside the Floyd family home, it didn't feel like justice. It felt like relief, temporary, fragile, incomplete. Justice, after all, would have meant George Floyd was still alive. What the world witnessed was accountability. One man, one conviction, not the system. And the system, it went right back to work. In the weeks following the verdict, 33 states introduced Back the Blue bills. Most increased penalties for obstructing police. Some created new felony charges for protesters. Others expanded qualified immunity protections under new names. This is how backlash operates, not loudly, but legislatively. The same week, Chauvin was sentenced to 22 and a half years. An unarmed black man named Dante Wright was shot and killed just 10 miles away by a veteran officer who claimed she mistook her gun for a taser. Another name, another press conference, another mother weeping on national television. I spoke with a civil rights attorney in Minneapolis. Chauvin wasn't the disease, she said. He was a symptom. We talked about the larger infrastructure, the union contracts that shield misconduct, the arbitration systems that reinstate fired officers, the pension laws that allow convicted cops to retire with full benefits. This isn't justice. It's institutional muscle memory. I visited George Floyd Square again, the intersection where he died. It had become a sacred space. Flowers, murals, candles, messages written in chalk, say his name. We will not forget. How many more? There I met a woman named Angela who comes every day to clean the memorial. She told me her teenage son had been stopped by MPD for looking suspicious while walking to school. No charges, just fear. This is our grief ground, she said, but also our battleground. I looked around. Tourists were taking selfies. Politicians made appearances. Brands launched social campaigns, but on the city budget sheet, MPD funding had increased. I requested city council meeting transcripts. What I read was infuriating. Council members who had once called for transformative change were now backpedaling. Citing public safety concerns, they quietly expanded overtime budgets and approved riot gear purchases. The protests had ended. The pressure had not. Then came the DOJ report. In June 2023, the Department of Justice released its findings from a two-year investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department. The summary was damning. The Minneapolis Police Department engages in a pattern or practice of conduct that deprives people of their rights under the Constitution and federal law. It confirmed everything I'd uncovered: routine excessive force, discriminatory stops, retaliation against protesters, racially biased policing. But here's the truth. We didn't need a DOJ report to know that. Black communities had been saying it for decades. George Floyd's death was not a revelation. It was a confirmation. And still, no federal legislation had passed. The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, introduced in 2020, remained stalled in Congress by 2025. I reached out to Floyd's daughter's legal guardian. He told me she's doing okay. She plays piano now, a small joy, a human detail, a life still growing. That's what the system doesn't count. It counts arrests. It counts budgets. It counts convictions, but it doesn't count lives lived or lost. Justice, as it's practiced, is often statistical, but true justice is human. And in that sense, we're still waiting.